So what we're going to do this evening, there's going to be a conversation, obviously, between Matt and I about process philosophy and Buddhism, really, simply put, yeah? That's what we're going to be doing. To put it very simply, the central act of Buddhism, what Buddhism is really about, whether it's here in Bethnal Green or it's in Tibet or it's in Burma or it's wherever it is, and the central act of a Buddhist is to go for refuge to the Three Jewels. That's how it's said, yes, go for refuge to the Three Jewels. By which I mean, go for refuge, which is actually change yourself in accordance with the Three Jewels, move towards the Buddha, who represents the transcendental ideal of Buddhism, and obviously that's the figure we have on our shrine, the transcendental ideal of Buddhism. Then move towards all those teachings that help you towards that transcendental ideal, not thoughts about things, but actually teachings that help you change yourself to become effectively more like the Buddha. You know, that's the Dharma. At least that's one way of talking about the Dharma. Although today, with our discussion, I want to talk about the Dharma as being how things really are. The Dharma in Buddhism is understood in those two ways. You know, how things really are, and all those teachings that lead to how things really are, in the sense of teachings that help you change in accordance with how things really are. Yeah. And then thirdly, you go for refuge to the Sangha, which is all of those people who have gained some kind of transcendental insight on that journey. Yeah. So that Buddhism is something deeply communal, yeah, and I want us to talk about that a bit later on. So the language of Buddhism is Gacchami, Buddhang Saranang Gacchami. Buddhists have chanted that all over the world, Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, which means I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Gacchami means I go. In other words, I act in ways to change my state of mind. I go. Not I think, not I believe, but Gacchami, I go. Yeah. So the reason why we're having Philosophy East is, even though Buddhism is skeptical, I think, about theory and doesn't have a final metaphysics, the Buddha very much valued clear thinking, particularly about muddled views and muddled thinking. Yeah. He particularly valued that, I would say. And the place that I want to start our conversation is that we're all enthralled to a kind of myth. We see things, part of the meaning of Buddhism. You know, the Buddha is a title, it means awake. And that means that we're not awake. And we're not awake because we're enthralled to all kinds of myths about life. Yeah. So what I thought we'd do in our conversation tonight is see whether Matt's philosophy, the philosophy of Schelling and Alfred North Whitehead, can help us go for refuge to the Three Jewels, which is a bit odd because You know, you didn't expect this quite until I talked to you about it. but he's managed it very well so far.
We haven't started yet.
Yeah, let's see how we go. you know, we'll end up in a violent disagreement, I'm sure. So let's start, though. Instead of starting, normally you talk about the Buddha, then the Dharma, and then the Sangha. But I want to start with the Dharma, because I think this is the area that we'll have most to say about. So by Dharma here, I mean how things really are. What is the true nature of the world and ourselves? That's what Buddhism is primarily concerned with. It's a wisdom tradition. Its concern is to move towards how things really are. And at its best, that's what philosophy is trying to do, as far as I understand it. When I was young, I assumed that philosophy was just a kind of complex word game. And in some branches of philosophy can get rather like that. But serious philosophers, serious thinkers of any kind, are always concerned with how can we understand ourselves and the world. Yeah? Now, one of the issues that I experience with myself and other Buddhists coming along here to the Buddhist Center is that we come to Buddhism with a kind of myth, a kind of view of things, which is not a Buddhist view of things. And put very simply, that's the myth of secular humanism, you know, or the mechanistic myths. The idea that, and you're getting more and more of this at the moment, the idea that mind is actually very like a computer. a very odd idea. You know, you're actually getting people seriously thinking about whether they could upload their mind to the internet. The assumption is that mind is very basically a computer, as if human beings, all they're doing is sort of computing, like we're information gathering devices. So one of the things that people come to Buddhism with is this myth that my mind is a bit like a computer, that I'm completely separate from the world and from things around me, that, you know, we were talking about Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher, and he talks of a buffered self, the idea that there's a complete boundary between me and the world, even between me and my body, and he contrasts that, Taylor contrasts that with a porous self, a pre-modern porous self. So the core delusion of Buddhism that Buddhism is trying to overcome is this idea that there's a really existing me in here that's fixed and unchanging in a really existing world of things. And, you know, of course, in modern ideas of things, that becomes a dead world of matter, unreachable from a living world of consciousness that's locked inside my brain and will completely disappear when I die. So I thought this would be a good place, long rambling introduction over, I thought this would be a good place to start. Is there any way in which Schelling and Whitehead and your own thought can help us start to break down that dichotomy, at least in thought, between a really existing self in here, probably as an epiphenomena of my brain, a bit like a computer, and a world of dead matter out there?
Yes. Well, I think so. I think there's a lot of overlap here between these two philosophers. Has everyone heard of Whitehead? A few of you. What about Schelling, the German idealist, Friedrich Wilhelm Joseph von Schelling, a couple?
Not a massively philosophical audience, but we'll get there.
You mentioned the transcendental ideal of Buddha. That we want to be like the Buddha. And interestingly, transcendental idealism is the name that Immanuel Kant, this German philosopher, gave to his own approach, where the self is different from Buddhism, obviously, because for Kant, the self is very important. Mm. The self and the mind are really the source of reality for Kant. And Schelling was one of the next generation of philosophers in Germany to inherit this idealistic point of view from Kant. And Schelling, and maybe more of you have probably heard of Hegel, who was seminary roommates with Schelling and Tübingen. And, you know, Hegel would go on to develop an absolute idealism where, in some ways, the self gets ballooned out to be encompass all of reality. Schelling had this interesting mediating position where he recognized that there's an imbalance here in the idealistic philosophy. He was worried about what happens to nature, to the world, to the universe, to the cosmos in this idealistic orientation. And so Schelling kind of flips the script, and rather than the Kantian point of view where all of reality is brought forth by the mind and in fact is just an appearance for the mind, Schelling says, well, wait a minute, nature is real too. And so he asks, what must nature be like such that human consciousness, such that our kind of awareness and agency could be possible? And his conclusion, the long and short of it, is it couldn't possibly be a machine. Nature must be living, it must be ensouled, and the human being is an expression of that living activity that permeates the entirety of the universe. And so that subject-object dichotomy that Kant was trying to overcome in some ways, and Hegel overcomes by, in some sense, making the mind half of that picture, the whole of things. And now, of course, I'm going to hear from the Hegelians on YouTube that this is not doing justice to Hegel, but we only have an hour and a half together. So. Schelling was trying to recognize the way in which what we call subject and object, mind and nature, are dependently co-arising, to borrow a Buddhist concept. You can't have one without the other, and you don't want to overly emphasize one side or the other. If you are going to try to move towards wholeness, the temptation is always to say, oh, well, it's all just a machine and consciousness is an epiphenomenon and it's just reducible to the mechanisms. Or to go the opposite extreme and say, it's all an illusion in our minds, right? And I think there are some schools of thought of when the Buddhists get a little carried away with metaphysics.
which they do sometimes.
that would say the mind-only school of Buddhism, for example. And Schelling was trying to hold the balance.
Before we go, what do you mean by ensouled nature, just to make sure that...
Yeah, so the mechanistic view would be that nature is a collection of objects and it's all surface. There's no interiority, there's no inner life. And an ensouled view of nature is to say, just like you and I have an inner perspective, we have feelings, emotions, motivations, that nature too, all the beings that compose nature, also have an interior dimension to them. And for Schelling, as for Whitehead, even the non-living world, as we would say, or the non-biological world, so atoms and stars, mountains and rivers, have a kind of subjectivity as well. It might not be recognizable to us at first as humans. It's a very different non-human kind of subjectivity. But ensouled just means that there's that interior dimension that we can, as human beings, resonate with the interior dimension of the natural world. Soul doesn't need to be conceived as a separate substance. We can imagine it in a more relational way, as both Schelling and Whitehead do. And so, similarly to Schelling, Whitehead has this view that I have called participatory, which is to say, again, that subject and object are like dynamically entangled. And so, you know, it's often said in spiritual circles that you don't see the world as it is, you see it as you are. But I think this participatory view is also trying to point out the ways in which we are shaped by the world, just as our view shapes what we take the world to be. And so in the Western tradition, in the modern period, everyone's heard of Descartes and his mind-body dualism, I think, therefore I am, and so on. Subject and object became severed. And Descartes' aim here was to objectify nature as everything external to the subject, to our thinking, and it can be measured, it can be calculated, it can be controlled through the application of various mathematical models. And that's been a very successful project. But the problem is that success has a shadow side. Because we've treated nature as something dead, we've actually killed a lot of the earth as a result of that, and are in the midst of a mass extinction because our subjectivity was such that we imagined that nature was machine-like, and so we went about making it more machine-like.
Why did Descartes get there? Do you know where did that come from? That view, that breaking between subject and object, because we're still living in that. Dualism, aren't we?
Very much so. Well, Descartes was a soldier in the religious wars in the first part of the 17th century, the Thirty Years' War. And there are all these religious factions in Europe, different forms of Protestantism and the Catholic Church. And having experienced all of that disagreement that was so intense that people were killing each other over it, he wanted to seek out a language, and for him that's mathematics and science, that would be... something everyone could agree about, and that create a new project for all peoples, regardless of their religious views, which he kind of said, religion is for the soul, it's for the interior dimension. Science is about nature, and we can all agree about what nature is because we can see it, we can measure it, we can do experiments, right? And so there's a good intention behind this. He really wanted to develop a language and a method and uplift science as a way of bringing these warring religions together. But the problem is he so sharply severed the two that a few hundred years later, we're still trying to clean up that mess. We feel alienated as subjects. We've paved over most of the natural world, making it more suitable to our own will and our own projects as human beings. And what Whitehead offers is a way of reconfiguring that whole arrangement. He still talks in terms of subject and object, but rather than thinking of them as these two totally distinct types of substance or entity or two types of things, Whitehead sees subject and object in a more temporal way, in a processual way. And so for Whitehead, in each moment of our experience, our subjective experience is actually constituted by and composed of the past flowing into it. But actually, he would say the objects of the past, objective data, flows into our present subjective experience in the immediate present. But each of those moments of experience is fleeting. It perishes and itself becomes an object that is then in the past to be inherited by the next subject, which is born.
What do you mean by object there, just to be?
The past.
Object in what sense?
An object for Whitehead is a subject which has already perished and passed into what he calls objective immortality.
Hmm. I've been trying to get my head around that.
Yes.
So can you say, just unpack that a bit more? You know, what is an example of that would help us?
Well, so in Buddhism, there's no self, right?
At least in one way of talking, yes. But
Whitehead's way of rendering what I think is a similar insight is to say that, you know, we obviously each have a subjective perspective, moment by moment. But the thing is, in Whitehead's point of view, the subject is momentary. So in each moment, a new subject is born. Hmm. The subject we were has died, but we inherit that past self, that past subject. That's why we remember who we are.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we tell a story about who we are.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Sometimes we get so tangled up in our story that we forget to be present.
Yeah.
And we forget that subjectivity is constantly arising, and you can't actually cling to that subject that you think you are. Mm. It's gonna die, it's gonna perish. Mm. When you cling to it, that leads to suffering, right?
And so it's in the, effectively, it's in the, it's always perishing, isn't it? That sense of,
yeah.
So that would be very, very close to Buddhism, as far as I understand it, yeah.
Right.
So that's that side of it. Then there's another side, isn't there, about the future?
Yes, so he coins this term, there's the present subject, the past object, and then he talks about the future in terms of the superject. Hmm. So, the superject for Whitehead is, in each moment, our capacity to anticipate what's going to happen next. This comes in the form of desire, intention, imagination about what we'd like to do, the possibilities that we explore that we would like to realize in the future. And so when we talk about the immediacy of our subjectivity moment by moment, it's not cut off from the past and the future. Mm. There's sort of blurry edges on each side of this temporal process. Mm. So we're always sort of in this tension between past and future, right? Mm. The present moment is always passing into the past, but we're also always anticipating the future, right? And so there is no freeze frame, instantaneous present for Whitehead. Mm. It's sort of fuzzy on either side, yeah.
Buddhism would talk about, you know, we tend to believe in a fixed and separate self.
Right.
So that's one of that saying is that the self, what we call the self, is an impermanent flux. And you're saying that that's, I very much like this idea that you're inheriting sort of past moments, past.
Yeah.
And my experience of that is particularly through stories and narratives, sense-making stories and narratives. And much of our life seems to me to be guided by the kind of sense-making narratives that we have, often not very consciously. And as you say, open to something, to possibilities in the future.
Right.
Is there a sense in which, and I might have got this wrong because my understanding is very limited, but that the future is somehow active in that scenario?
The future doesn't exist yet for Whitehead, but it's active in the sense that these possibilities function as lures. Some are more attractive than others. And so the future, while it isn't yet actual, has a certain structure of potentiality, right? The past is done, settled, fully actualized. We can't change the past. We can change how we interpret the past, which is to say how we inherit it in the present.
Right, yeah.
The future is open-ended. And so, you know, often people who are into precognition will ask me, what does Whitehead say about that? And while there are certain things that are more probable in the future, to the idea that you could know for certain what is going to happen at some future date, for Whitehead, that for his metaphysics, that's not possible.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Maybe there is empirical evidence to suggest that his metaphysics needs to be adjusted, but I personally haven't seen it yet.
Right, yeah, yeah.
The future is this matrix of possibilities, right? And some are more probable than others.
Yeah.
But because they haven't happened yet, we can't be sure.
And they have a kind of lure.
In the
sense of that they appeal to the subject in a certain way.
Yeah.
Or don't appeal, because I suppose you can be lured by the negative as well as the positive, is that right?
Sure.
In your mind?
If you're an addict, say, yeah. You're thinking about that next hit.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is alluring to you because it makes you feel a certain way. And so we seek it out. And we can get trapped in these habits as a result of, well, really, it's about repeating the past. You know, our past experience conditions us to expect certain futures. And so from a Whiteheadian point of view, lifting up creativity as the ultimate nature of reality for him is a way of freeing us from attachment to habits that we have acquired in the past and reminding ourselves that we're not determined by that past.
Yeah, it's very easy now to think we are determined by the past.
Yes.
To think we're bound, you know, particularly from a Freudian, you know, that we're bound to somehow unconsciously repeat, you know, traumas from the past and so on. What would how would Whitehead respond to that?
Well, I mean, certainly what we inherit moment by moment is playing a big role in shaping who and what we are.
Yeah.
And we can't change the past, as I said.
Mm.
And there are these knots and tangles and traumas that we inherit. And, you know, I think a way of understanding trauma in a Whiteheadian context would be to say that it forecloses our sense of the openness of the future.
Mm. I see.
Right?
Or it appears to, at least.
It appears to us to foreclose the possibilities open to us in the future. And there's a sense in which, you know, I don't mean this to disparage anyone, but so often what happens with trauma is it seems that we kind of get attached to being victimized and are unable to see that something else is possible for us. And I mean, for very good reason, we might be stuck in that place because something horrible was done to us and we don't trust the world anymore. You know, but if the way that metaphysics could actually be instructive for our spiritual life and not just a bunch of theories that we, you know, debate over beer, is, you know, by reminding us that the structure of reality is such that we're not determined by our past. And it's not that we have total free will. We have to inherit the past. But how we inherit it, we're deciding moment by moment by moment.
So say a little bit more about we're deciding, because that seems very important to me. Because I do think this is... We're trying to get to a point of freedom, aren't we? Where we're, as far as I can understand, where which we're kind of acknowledging and at best understanding our past, and not feeling pressured to live out again. And that there's a sounds like something like the Buddhist idea of a point of freedom that you still can choose. That agency never gets down to zero. That's how Taylor would put it.
Right.
Can you say a little bit more about that? That is there a freedom for the, because we haven't got a sort of substantial self that really exists and perdures through time, which is very, that's what Buddhism is saying. It sounds very much like what you're saying and Whitehead's saying. That creates a kind of freedom, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, so like I said, the ultimate nature of reality for Whitehead is creativity.
Right, yeah.
Creativity is this process that's new in each moment. And so for each of us, in our inner experience, as much as for the pebbles we and the blades of grass that we step on as we walk, the stars, everything in the universe is new in each moment because of the ultimate nature of reality is this creative onrush that's not blind. It's not just, you know, a indiscriminate spraying in every direction of accidental expressions. It's guided by what Whitehead calls God.
Which we'll come back to, but carry on for a moment.
So for, you know, Whitehead's conception of the divine is probably unlike anything you ever heard before in relation to that term, as is true for most of the terms that he uses. But he talks about God having these two poles. And I won't go too much into it because we'll come back to
that later. We'll come back to God, but carry on,
There's the primordial nature of God and the consequent nature of God. The primordial nature, Whitehead describes as this ideal ordering of that space of possibility. And so we talked about the lure of the future, that these possibilities are, in some sense, we experience them as arranged in a certain way, as even having a certain composition. And for Whitehead, that composition has a divine source. God doesn't create the world, for Whitehead, but God lures the world towards the most ideal possibility. And so he says, the primordial nature of God is like a mirror held up to each being to reflect back to it its most ideal possibility that could be decided upon in the next moment, right? And most of the time we don't live up to that ideal because we're inheriting our past and we feel inadequate to the realization of that ideal. But in each moment we have this little injection of what he calls the initial eros, the Greek word for love or desire. This initial eros, or this lure that reminds us, if we're capable of apprehending it, of what's possible for us. And it's there that I think our freedom comes in, that we're always gifted this this ideal possibility that we could realize in the next moment.
I mean, is that another way of talking about values? Values, it seems to me that you can't imagine experience without the nature of values.
Right.
That, you know, if you see someone being honest, you see someone being kind, you do feel very genuinely honest and kind. You feel very, very drawn to it. That consciousness is sort of value laden. Is that, I don't know whether that sort of crosses with what Whitehead's saying there.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's this, one of these other dichotomies in Western philosophy that it doesn't so much start with Descartes, though the seeds of it are there. It's David Hume who separates is and oughts, fact and value, right? It's another way of rendering the subject-object division that, you know, science is concerned with the facts, right? Whereas art and religion, morality are concerned with values. Whitehead would say that actually value permeates nature.
Right, yeah.
And
what would he mean by why values permeate nature? Because it seems to me so important, this question of value. And I think one of the issues for modern life is that we're losing a sense of values or are confused about it.
So creativity wants to express itself. And I'm you know, anthropomorphizing something that's not you know, the ultimate nature of reality is not like a human being. And so when I say, oh, it wants to express itself, that, you know, that's a way of speaking. But here we all are. This creative onrush has given rise to intricate, beautiful beings capable of such rich experience. And so aim is intrinsic to the nature of the universe. And for Whitehead, evolution isn't just about mere natural selection, where it's sort of this passive process of what happens to survive in a given environment has offspring and endures. For Whitehead, that's happening. But there's also this other dimension of subjectivity aiming at a more ideal future, aiming at the intensification of experience, is how he would put it.
Or a movement towards or attraction to value?
Yes, to realize possibilities, to bring them into actuality, to bring them into embodiment.
And that does feel foundational, doesn't it? That you, like before the event, it feels like there are intrinsic values in the universe. Certainly Buddhism would say that. And that you can be open to them. Of course, you cannot be. You can even disavow them. But they seem to be present in the world.
Yeah, there is a Dharma, there is a way. Whitehead says nature has a tendency to be in tune. And so there's something aesthetic. Nature seeks beauty. So when I say, you know, the aim here is intensification of experience, it's intensification of aesthetic experience so as to enrich our capacity for the experience of beauty.
So I want to talk about that a bit more, but I thought let's before we get to that, let's do a little bit of a side thing and talk a little more about Whitehead as a person, because we sort of started in with this thought, haven't we? And I'd be interested to hear a little bit about how did he get to that. He started as a mathematician,
yeah.
Became and so on, with Bertrand Russell writing the Principia Mathematica, which I don't know even if that's how you pronounce it, but something like that.
Yeah.
You can imagine I haven't read it, but then nor has anybody else. let's be clear. one of the things that I was struck by is Whitehead and his rugby tackle.
Oh, yes.
And I thought, let's start with Whitehead and rugby. And how did we get from... You'll get why I'm going there. Where did we get from Whitehead? What's that rugby tackle? I was very struck by that as a thought.
Yeah.
And then a little bit about how he got to these thoughts, which for me, there's something tantalizing. But the reason I'm interested is because Cotton, bless him, understand a word he's saying when I've tried to read very much. Mm. Apparently, you can even do courses in reading Whitehead, can't you?
I teach them.
Yes. Oh, do you? There you go. What's going on? That sounds great. You're like, you'd be such a good man for that. anyway, sorry. Let's have a bit of a course in reading. No, but I thought it'd be good to talk a bit about the man, because, you know, this philosophy comes out of his life, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll quickly start at the beginning. I mean,
he
comes from, his father was an Anglican schoolmaster, and his grandfather was an Anglican schoolmaster, and I don't know how many great-great-greats it is, but in the 17th century, George Whitehead was this Quaker religious freedom fighter, and Whitehead's got this long line of, I think, inspiring the spiritual impulse running through his lineage there. He attends the Sherborne School and was on the rugby team.
Oh, yeah.
And was a star. Hmm. He was quite a good rugby player.
Which is unusual for a philosopher, I
think. Oh, yeah. He's a very embodied man. He was short like me, but quite stocky. And there's some photographs that have surfaced more recently of him with his team. And he has a fierce look in his eye. Hmm. But then he studies mathematics at Cambridge, and then he at Trinity College, and becomes a fellow and begins to teach mathematics. Bertrand Russell was one of his students and quickly became a collaborator. They wrote this, it was supposed to be four volumes, they wrote three volumes and developed their own notation for the symbolic logic they were developing. Three volumes, you know what they were trying to prove logically?
I do, but you tell us.
Well, one plus one equals two.
How hard can it be?
You know, a six-year-old knows that.
Yeah, yeah.
But to actually logically prove that without there being any intuitive gaps need to be filled in by something that's not something that could be plugged into a computer.
Right.
It took quite a number of pages, and in fact, they didn't really succeed. There were a lot of paradoxes that arose and patches that were needed and axioms to make it work. Yeah. And Russell was kind of devastated by that, and Whitehead was liberated by that. In the 19-teens, this guy named Albert Einstein was becoming quite famous, and Whitehead was one of the few physicists, mathematicians, who could understand this new four-dimensional understanding of space-time. And so he got pulled more and more into applied math or physics, and recognized that not only because of Einstein, but the beginnings of quantum theory, that this old mechanistic vision of the cosmos no longer made any sense. Our whole conception of matter and space and time and causality and energy that physicists were very comfortable with in the 19th century and for a few hundred years since Newton, that these ideas no longer made any sense. We needed a new understanding of what nature is, what space and time are. And so he got to work doing metaphysics to reimagine the basic structure of the universe so that it would be brought more into alignment with what science itself had discovered. And so in the 1920s, he starts doing philosophy of science more, trying to understand nature in a new way as unbifurcated. So he has this idea of the bifurcation of nature, which is kind of like Cartesian dualism, but it's a little bit different. He was very concerned that physics, despite relativity and quantum theory, was stuck in this view of the really real being made of math. And we don't see nature as it really is, but we have these equations that allow us to predict what's going to happen next. And so he said, we've gotten to the situation where physics says that nature is this mathematical conjecture. And that the human mind and our inner experience is kind of like a dream. It's not part of nature.
Yeah. We still have that very much now, don't we?
We do.
As a background assumption.
Yeah. Whitehead told us to stop, but we kept doing it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have the conjecture and the dream. Mm. And he's, you know, he has these very witty lines in his 1920 book, The Concept of Nature, about how, you know, the poets should really congratulate themselves. Like, you know, Wordsworth is thinking he's singing an ode to nature, but he's singing an ode to his own mind, if this bifurcated view is right. So Whitehead wants to overcome that, and he defines nature as what we are aware of in perception, such that the red hue of the sunset and the electromagnetic waves, in terms of which the physicists would want to describe it, they're both part of nature. Nature is what we are aware of in perception, and we're not with our senses aware of those electromagnetic waves, but our technological extensions allow us to extend our senses in some sense. And so for Whitehead, he's not dismissing science, but he's saying we need to reinterpret it so that it's not in conflict with our experience. Then by 1925, he's invited to Harvard. He's 63 years old, and he teaches his first, did I say 25? He was invited in 24. In the fall of 24, he says in his first lecture at Harvard that this is actually his first philosophy course. He's teaching it, and it's also the first philosophy course that he had been in. But of course, he's been, you know, studying and steeped in Western philosophy for his whole life. He was a member of the Cambridge Apostles when he was in school, which was this society that, you know, they studied Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, and he could recite whole passages from memory. And so he gets to Harvard and starts to develop this new cosmology. And you mentioned this rugby story. So one of his colleagues at Harvard is this idealist philosopher named Hawking. And he was teaching a seminar with Hawking and getting a little bit frustrated with his idealistic perspective on anything, and so on everything. And so Whitehead says, being tackled in rugby, that's the real. You know, being buried in the scrum and having your shins hacked with cleats, that's the real, right? Anyone who's been tackled knows that there's a reality out there.
Yes, indeed.
And it can whack you over the head, you know? And so he was very keen on making sure that as we overcome the subject-object division, that we nonetheless recognize that we are subject to a world that is larger than us, and it doesn't always conform to our expectations.
Yes, I always think there's something very important about that rugby tackle for some reason.
Yes,
I haven't played much rugby, surprise. But the grounding in that seems very important to me for thought itself.
Yeah,
that we don't get carried away. I mean, Buddhism is very concerned by being carried away by abstractions and speculations and so on.
Yeah, and we forget about the body.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Whitehead's trying to bring the body back into philosophy. Since Descartes, I mean, you go back to Plato, the body gets forgotten. And he says, you know, Western philosophers have been obsessed with their visual experience, which is the most disembodying of the senses. It makes the world feel like it's out there. And we've neglected our visceral feelings, he said. He says, you know, nobody ever shows up and says, here I am, and I've brought my body with me. There's a synergy between mind and body, and he thinks we need to bring that more to the fore in our philosophizing.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that's part of this idea that we think we can upload our mind to the internet, you know, is, again, this the idea that we are just a sort of complex piece of computational machinery, really.
Right.
Still following that sort of tendency.
It's a human tendency that, you know, the Greeks thought the mind was like a wax tablet. You know, in the 19th century, the mind was a steam engine. And then in the early 20th century, it's a, you know, maybe a radio receiver or something. But now, yeah, it's a computer, of course. So we're always tempted to reach for the most, you know, close at hand analogy from the technologies that are prominent in our era. In Descartes' time, it was the mechanical clock. And so that's, analogies are one thing, but to forget it's a metaphor and imagine that the mind really is a computer is quite dangerous, because we're at the point where I think we will start to be able to upload something to the internet, but whether or not anyone is home, it could just be a model of a person's personality, and everybody else might be tempted to mistake it for them, but there's actually nobody there.
Yes,
you drop the body and think that you've got this model, an AI model of that person, that you're still talking to them, but that might just be empty of any internal, sentient experience. There's no one there to suffer.
Yeah, there's no ensouled being, to use that language.
There's no ensouled being. Yeah.
So I interrupted you. We were still in Harvard with Whitehead teaching.
Yeah. Well, he was quite popular as a professor there. Mm-hmm. Had a tremendous influence on many students. And when he was done teaching at Harvard, which at that time was only for men, he would go over to Radcliffe, the women's college, and teach the women afterwards. Mm-hmm. Suzanne Langer is a very popular, well-known American philosopher of aesthetics and art. Was very influenced by Whitehead. She studied with him there. Mary Parker Follett was influenced by Whitehead. She's an organizational theorist who applied this process point of view to politics as well as business and thinking about how we work together and coming over our own selfish sense of individuality to make decisions in a way that elevates the value that can be achieved if we're willing to see the intimate relationality of our humanity. So he had quite an influence, and he taught at Harvard until 1937 when he retired. It was just at this time that a different kind of philosophy was coming into prominence, really already in the 1920s, analytic philosophy, philosophy of language, the obsession with solving these logical puzzles became dominant in the English-speaking world especially. And after he died, without the charisma of the living Whitehead to sort of keep this more dynamic cosmic philosophy alive and keep people interested in it, it kind of went into cold storage. And it wasn't, he dies in 1947. And it wasn't until this late 60s and 70s that the American theologians actually started to bring his work back into the conversation, but in theology, not so much in philosophy. So people like Charles Hartshorne, who was at University of Chicago, and his student, John Cobb Jr., who passed away recently, was an important mentor of mine, Charles Hartshorne. And this was the case for up until I'd say the early 2000s, Whitehead was generally only talked about by the theologians, and they developed what's called process theology. But more recently, there's a bit of a Whitehead renaissance going on. The philosophers are interested again. The architects are interested. The ecologists are interested. The artists, everybody is interested from a multiplicity of disciplines. And so it's an exciting time to be a Whiteheadian. Yeah, I get invited to have conversations like this.
So we're going to have a cup of tea in a minute, but let's see if we can go. I mean, there's two things in my mind. Partly is I'm very interested in Whitehead and Wordsworth. Whitehead is a very deep reader of Wordsworth, particularly the Prelude. Again and again, Wordsworth reappears as a great figure for philosophers as well as poets. Perhaps we could use that as a way of moving into Whitehead and imagination. Mm-hmm. And then let's have a cup of tea, because we'll need one. And then after that, we can go to the Sangha and the Buddha.
Yeah, well, I think it was his daughter, Jessie, who reported that Whitehead had a copy of the Prelude that was falling apart, and he read it every day like scripture. It was his Bible. And he has a whole chapter in his 1925 book, Science and the Modern World, called The Romantic Reaction. And Wordsworth and Shelley and other romantic nature poets figure prominently in that chapter. And they were reacting against this mechanistic conception of nature that strips value from nature. And he thinks that when we do strip value from nature, we're actually doing objective harm to it. Because aesthetics isn't something, and moral value, it's not something human beings just project onto the world. In fact, our values come from nature. We inherit our values from nature, in Whitehead's view, and he thought that Wordsworth had a particular talent for expressing that. And Whitehead has his poetic moments, but I think if you want to understand the Whiteheadian worldview, you can get it in Wordsworth.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. So that's a good place for you. Let's have a cup of tea, but I'd like to come back to that idea that values, because that starts to sound like a poorer self.
Yes.
Go back to Taylor's definition, you know, between a buffered self and a poorer self. That starts to sound like self isn't just locked in, which is what we're particularly been exploring just now, trying to free ourselves from that kind of dualistic way of thinking, and that there's a real world out there and a subjective world in here, and once this in here disappears, the real world carries on blindly without us. That's where we've been, that's the right. area we've been exploring, but it'd be good to go back to that.
Okay.
But let's just have a cup of tea for now, and then you look like you need it, so let's have a cup of tea. We're all doing very well, and then we'll come back and see if we can get a bit more into this, yeah? I was trying to frame this in the frame of going for refuge to the Dharma. As I say, going for refuge is the central Buddhist axis, and it means actually taking the next step in your life. It's not thinking stuff, it's not believing stuff so much. There's real value in thinking things. Mm-hmm. It's more, okay, what the Buddha would say, okay, what do you need to do to get more like reality, to see reality as it is more? And that's traditionally talked about going for refuge. Yeah? And going for refuge to the Dharma is going for refuge to how things really are, which is at the same time saying we do not see how things really are. And one of the things I think we were crossing over on there, and see whether you think this is right, is that Whitehead seems to be, like Buddhism, trying to say a critique of substantialism. Mm-hmm. We have a very deep instinct to make things where no things exist. This is a sort of fundamental insight of Buddhism, that we make ourselves a thing, we make the world a thing. Weirdly, we even make ideas things, which we then feel very protective of and want to defend and so on. Sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes that's not a good thing. But even we reify abstractions into things. But we human beings have got a very strong tendency to make things where no things exist. Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me, and you know, tell me if I'm wrong, is that Whitehead's trying to have something of that insight.
Yeah. There's no such thing as a thing in process philosophy. Or if there is a thing, you really have to emphasize the gerund at the end, the ing, or add an extra one to really bring the point home, thinging.
Right, right.
There are only processes, and what a process is a nexus of relations. Huh. And he has this fallacy that he likes to repeat in all of his later books, the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. We tend to concretize or reify ideas. Mm. You know, matter, mind, self. And the idea is not that we have to, you know, contort our language and never use nouns and make everything into a verb, but just to recognize that the structure of reality is not necessarily the same as the structure of our grammar.
Right. Yeah.
And this way of thinking that goes back to Aristotle, that is the subject-predicate structure of our language, leads to a certain kind of metaphysics. The substance property metaphysics, things with qualities that inhere in those things. Mm. So you know, there's the red stop sign. You know, there's we think that there's some kind of a distinct, separate thing there. This octagon shape. Well, I'm talking about the U.S. I don't know if you have those, but imagine there's an octagon shape, and what Whitehead is suggesting is that there's not some solid substance underlying the world that we perceive with our senses. What we perceive as color, and even what we perceive and call physical stuff, is actually a function of relationship. Not just the relationships of the stuff out there, but a relationship between our own experience and what we perceive. Mm. And so overcoming the fallacy of misplaced concreteness is just recognizing the fluidity of reality and that we're always participating in it. And it's not that, you know, when I said earlier that the world is as we perceive it, or that it's not about so much that there's an independent reality that we can't really touch, but what we experience is more about a projection of our own subjectivity. It's more that we're always a confluence of causes and conditions, and it's a very Buddhist view, and Whitehead says as much himself in Process and Reality, his magnum opus, that this cosmology actually bears more resemblance to Buddhism than it does to the Western philosophical tradition. And so he's trying to overcome this tendency we have to reify things into substances. And it's not so much that he would say there is no self, so much as that the self is new in each moment.
Right.
And that the self is a network of relationships.
Which is, when Buddhists say there is no self, you can get that wrong. It doesn't mean to say that there's not a locus of,
You don't want to get attached to emptiness.
Yeah, that's right. And, the Buddhism is simply saying there's no fixed, separate self. Yeah. That's the real thing. That is, we treat it as a thing, treat ourselves as a thing in a world of things. So let's now try and talk about this question of going for refuge to the Sangha. And this is perhaps one of my own little bugbears, if you'll bear with me, which is one of the attitudes people bring to Buddhism very easily is that Buddhism is something you do on your own with your eyes closed. That it's interesting because we always, the great figure of Buddhism is the meditating Buddha. And that has become the image of Buddhism in the modern West, the westernized world, as you call it, as if what Buddhism boils down to is something you do in privacy, just on yourself, with your mind. Of course, Buddhism really values meditation and teaches meditation. But Buddhism is deeply communal. One of the things I'm wanting to try and say more is why any kind of human life, never mind spiritual life, is always a communal life. It's a we thing, not a me thing. And it's very easy to get stuck in a kind of me thing. And there's something odd about contemporary Buddhism, as it's sometimes taught, where it can start to look like that's what it's about, a sort of deeper version of a me thing. Philosophers like Zizek has criticized that. He calls it Western Buddhism. Really, it's a kind of misunderstanding of Buddhism, and that there's something in that. So I wonder whether I'm particularly struck from what I've been reading and listening to you about is the relational nature of life. And you've touched on this already, that our experience is relational. It's between. It's not something that just inheres in me. I wonder whether you Whitehead or Schelling can help us with seeing that if we are to deepen as a person, we need to deepen with others, in relationship to others, not sort of, try and work it all out in isolation in our head, in this sort of lonely, buffered self that Taylor sort of talks about.
There's this wonderful line in Process and Reality where Whitehead says, "We find ourselves in a buzzing world amid a democracy of fellow creatures." And so one of my teachers, influenced by Whitehead, an influence on me, I didn't know him, Thomas Berry. He was the teacher of my teacher, I should say, Brian Swim at CIS. And what Thomas Berry says in a very Whiteheadian spirit is the world is not a collection of objects, it's a communion of subjects, right? And so hopefully the point earlier was brought home that subjectivity is not something that just human beings have, or are, rather. It's not something that's just in animals and plants and single cells, but subjectivity for Whitehead is present in atoms and stars. It's the basic structure of reality is a series of interrelated, he calls them actual occasions of experience. And these are not isolated occasions of experience. They're bound up in a network of relationships. And so at the human level, this gets brought home by people like Martin Luther King Jr., who says, "I cannot be who I am supposed to be until you are who you are supposed to be, and you cannot be who you are supposed to be until I am who I am supposed to be." I mentioned Mary Parker Follett earlier, who applied Whitehead's ideas to organizational management. She says, you know, you never encounter me and I never encounter you. What you encounter is me plus you. And right, I encounter you plus me.
Right, yeah.
Hyphen, hyphen, hyphen.
Yeah, 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 cool.
Because we're always bound up in this relational matrix and becoming other together from what we were before we encountered each other. And even when we close our eyes and meditate, there's not really a unified identity in there somewhere that we discover. So even when we're doing the me thing, if we're honest, there's a multiplicity of me, right? And there's a way in which psychologically we come into relationship with others and in the intimate forms of relationship, friendship, romance, whatever it may be, it very often feels to me at least like others know me or at least facets of me much better than I know myself. And we need that reflection in order to continue to deepen and learn about ourselves. There's so much about us that we can't see ourselves.
And how have we, because in a certain sense, when you start to unpack it, it's sort of so obvious, you couldn't possibly think of a person separate. You know, we're born into a community, aren't we? You couldn't imagine consciousness separate, but how have we got there?
I'm glad you mentioned the birthing piece. I mean, to the extent that we have a sense of self, self-esteem, let's say, that's actually a gift first from mother, parents, loving community. So the sense of individuality that we value so much in the West, for it to be healthy, it actually needs to be born in the context of loving communities, right? To feel self-confidence, self-esteem, a sense of being of value. You can't really make that yourself, right? That needs to be reflected to you, and it needs to start at a very young age. And so it's, where do we get a sense of being able to encounter otherness? Well, I feel it's probably the case, and there's some evidence in developmental psychology that it is the case, that the, you know, those first few months with the mother and the infant are actually where, you know, mother is the first other. And if you don't have that proper bond initially, then you can't encounter otherness in a healthy way later in life. And so we're deeply, intimately relational beings at a biological level. We're made of a community of trillions of cells that somehow miraculously function so as to maintain the coherence of our organism. And do any of the individual cells know what they're doing? Maybe. But what do we make as a community? What sorts of societies do we bring forth when we're able to enter into that deep, intimate relationality? And you know, that type of mutuality isn't just about sacrificing one's own sense of joy and connectedness. We actually enhance our own inner experience by coming more into intimate relationship. So this isn't about giving anything up. It's about gaining more, heightening the joy and love that we can experience.
And did Whitehead particularly bring that back into philosophy? Because it did seem to have got lost, as if we can think of ourselves as utterly separate and so on.
I think he did. He certainly, you know, as I mentioned, the theologians brought him, kept him in print, and thawed his books out of cold storage, and his conception of the divine, unlike most Jewish and Christian and Muslim understandings of what theism is, that the God is separate from the universe. God created the world by fiat as the separate, you know, in a fish tank or something. And God didn't need to do that. God doesn't need the world. The world needs God, but God doesn't need the world. So this traditional form of monotheism is deeply challenged by Whitehead. There is no God without the world. There's no world without God, but there's no God without the world either. And so there's an intimate relationship between the divine and the cosmos in Whitehead's view. And that changes a lot of the things that have led people away from conceptions of God. And I think ends up, you know, Whitehead's view of the relationship between God and the world, though the language might be a stumbling block initially, might end up bringing us towards a deeper sense of resonance with Buddhism, where, you know, there's a kind of Buddha nature that is present in all things. Mm. And Whitehead would say that the divine is present in all things, as this, again, this ideal, you know, that draws us towards what's possible.
Mm. Let's go on, because that takes us to this jewel of the Buddha.
Yeah.
The Buddha the Buddha of Buddhism, as it were, is the ideal, you know, the transcendental person, you could say. My own teacher, Sangharakshita, says the Buddha is a mystic marriage between the immanent and the transcendental, between humanity and enlightenment, between the universal and the personal. When the Buddha talked about his sense of the world, his perception, his insight into the world, his enlightenment, he was particularly keen to say, look, that, you know, one way of thinking about things is that is nihilistic, you know, that when you die, consciousness is wiped out. I mean, he didn't use this language, of course, but, you know, that, and he said that nihilism, any idea of nihilism, for instance, at death, consciousness is completely obliterated, that was wrong. He said that nihilism is a wrong position. Yeah. Interestingly, he also said it was ugly, which I'm very struck by, because he uses the same epithets for eternalism as he does for nihilism, but for nihilism, he seems to add the word ugly as well as everything else. But also the Buddha was very clearly saying it's not eternalistic either. So his teaching...
The middle way.
Is the middle way, yeah. And that isn't somewhere, in between eternalism on one hand and nihilism on the other hand. It's above and beyond that distinction. So the traditional metaphor is that you've got two fires burning and they sort of draw your attention. And high above that is a star. Mm. And that is the sort of middle way. We tend to, in any moment, either be slightly nihilistic in our thinking and therefore in shaping how we act, or we're slightly eternalistic in our thinking and therefore shaping how we act. Where would Whitehead be in that? Because it sounds, as soon as, for me, to my ear, as soon as we get to God, you know, I go over a kind of speed bump. I mean that sort of in all due respect. That people's experience, I can understand.
Yeah.
I've talked to many people who've had experience with it, they would use that language. I always want to say, let's keep to the experience. Mm. But I'm nervous about the word.
Yeah?
Sure. Because the word has got these ancient connotations.
Yep.
And for Buddhism, it's, but there's no God in Buddhism and there's no kind of place for one. So I don't know whether that helps you say something, but.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned the two sides of the divine for Whitehead.
Yeah. Yeah.
The primordial nature and the consequent nature of God. And, we are in between those two natures. The physical world and our experience is sort of, we exist within God in a sense, but between these two sides of God. And I haven't mentioned the consequent nature yet.
Yeah, let's perhaps do a bit of both again, just to remind us.
So the primordial nature is, for Whitehead, that original impulse that is itself an expression of creativity, but it's the first expression of creativity.
Yeah, like a sort of prime mover?
He does say it's similar to Aristotle's prime mover, except for Aristotle, that prime mover was a solution to a problem in physics, the origin of motion. And Whitehead says we don't have that problem in contemporary physics.
Right.
We have an analogous problem, however, which is how do you go from infinite possibility, the quantum vacuum, say, to finite actuality? And so Whitehead isn't the prime mover, but is the possibilitect, to coin a term. Not architect, possibilitect, as in the orderer of possibilities that allows for infinite possibility to take on definite form, right? And so you could think of the primordial nature of God as something like a filter of this infinite creativity that allows each of us as finite beings to not be overwhelmed by that infinitude, but to have a sense of relevant possibility moment by moment as a result of this divine filtering. But remember, each moment of our experience is always perishing, passing away,
yeah.
right? And so maybe this is Whitehead's gesture towards the nihilistic side. It's like, you can't hold on to whatever you think you are. That will perish and become past. Now, the consequent nature of God is God, as Whitehead says, the fellow sufferer who understands. This is God, not as the order of possibility, but as that aspect of the divine that is feeling everything which occurs, remembering everything which has ever occurred. It's the part of the divine that changes and grows with the world, right? The primordial nature doesn't change. Mm. The consequent nature does change. Mm. And so there is an aspect of the divine which is fully immanent and which is with us in all of our joy and in all of our pain. Mm. And there's an element of this in some of the theistic traditions. It's quite odd to me that many Christians seem to forget about the incarnation, that you know the divine became human, became part of the physical world and died. And I think if we emphasize that more and overcome this sense of the divine needing to be large and in charge and in control, actually that incarnational view is quite similar to Whitehead's. He didn't identify as a Christian.
Right, interesting, yeah.
But there's this sense of this incarnational emphasis in his process theology.
And why did he feel that we needed it? Because, why did he think we needed it? Because for me, it's like, why even, you've got this idea in Whitehead, as far as I understand it, you've got this sort of primordial creativity that
keeps things in motion.
Yeah, you sort of lose out words, don't you? But why do you need the concept at all? Or why you need the language at all? Why not some other language? Especially because he clearly doesn't believe in the kind of old man in the sky, which hardly anyone believes in anymore. And then, well, at least people around here. I mean, a lot of people around here do as well. But we can forget that we're in this little bubble where actually most people still believe in God in that traditional sense.
That's the thing. When Whitehead looks at the history of religious experience, and he doesn't just look in the West, and he wants his metaphysics actually to be the basis for a kind of interreligious dialogue such that all the world's great wisdom traditions would recognize themselves in it, at least to some degree.
I see. Yeah.
Right. Whether or not that's the case is an empirical matter, and we're going to work that out right here.
We'll get there.
But the history of religious experience across the planet is part of the data that the philosopher needs to take into consideration when they construct a cosmology. And the history of religious experience, in large part, with Buddhism as a prominent exception, perhaps. Mm. Is suggestive of a kind of intuition of a personal dimension to the universe. That personhood is not an accidental feature of this universe, and that whatever the human being is some type of expression or exemplar of this deeper personalizing tendency in things. And so this tendency to imagine a kind of a personal sort of God seems to be part of what much of humanity has done and, looks like a person to me. I don't think it's that foreign to the Buddhist tradition. I mean, Siddhartha Gautama was a person. Not a supernatural being.
No, that's right. That's very important in Buddhism that, the Buddha was born as we are born is how we recite that. What the Buddha achieved, we too can achieve.
Yeah. And I think there are heretical, admittedly, interpretations of Christianity where Jesus, too, was born of a woman who probably wasn't just impregnated by an angel. But
I don't think the Catholic Church would like that.
That's okay with me. I think, there might need to be some reforms here and there in the institution. But, I relate to beings like Buddha and Christ and Krishna, there are more, as not being captured by this or that institution, or this or that form of institutionalized religion. And I think history bears that out, that these beings inspire people, often outside of any institutional context, not necessarily outside of community, but outside of the hierarchical structures that you know, we tend to form when we think we got the truth. And so, yeah, for that reason, I think just looking at the history of religious experience and the fact that if we understand the human being as an example of the deeper, the deepest tendencies of cosmic evolution, rather than an exception.
Yeah, which is what tends to happen, isn't it? Like we've just sort of popped up as a kind of lucky mistake almost. You
know? We're the apex predator who survived the best in this bloodbath. The other view is that, you know, evolution is driven not just by bloodlust and red tooth and claw types of warfare among species, but actually wisdom and compassion are latent in the nature of things, trying to find ever fuller expressions and embodied forms, and that the human being is trying to realize these values. And, you know, in Buddhism, being incarnated as a human being is a very auspicious occasion, right? Because we have a chance to really bring about a different way of life on this planet if we can realize those two values.
I mean, the great matter of, for Buddhism, of being, we would call sort of reborn rather than reincarnated, because that sounds like there is a real self that is, that sort of puts on another outfit called another person, you know? So the Buddhist term is again becoming. That what you are is a becoming, and that continues after death.
That's right.
And the value of that is that, well, very traditionally, is that the human realm that we're in has a kind of balance of pleasure and pain. And so we're not in so much pain that we can't reflect, and we're not in so much pleasure that we can't be bothered to reflect. You know, we're not in so much pain that we can't think, and we're not in so much pleasure that we don't need to think. That's traditionally what the human realm, why it's so important. We human beings in Buddhist thought can gain enlightenment. But I'm very interested by this idea of the person nature of things. I think that's there's something very fruitful in that. That we are an example of something. You know, you mentioned Tathagatagarbha, which is, you know, the idea that, of an indwelling Buddha or Buddha nature. The best way I think of understanding that is as a poetic description, not in the sense of some sort of airy-fairy. You know, people, when they say poetic description, they think you mean something you could have said much more sensibly and rationally, but you've weirdly gone for this sort of poetic mode in a weird sort of woo-woo moment. So I definitely don't mean that. I mean that the Tathagatagarbha is a poetic experience of how it feels in certain insightful experiences. That it really does feel like, and I've even had touches of this myself, that you experience something that feels as if it's always been there. That you rediscover something that's always there. Like, I don't know, the experience of flying in a plane and going up through the clouds and there's a sun and it's always been shining, it's just you didn't see it. It's just that Buddhism wouldn't want to make a metaphysics of that. Oh, it has always been there, because that becomes eternalism, or it wasn't there and you just discovered it, which becomes nihilism. Buddhism's very, very cautious, metaphysically in that way. Because the Buddha would say each way can lead you into problems. And there's a little kind of disquisition on that. But I don't know whether that provokes you in any way. But I am struck by this thought of the person nature of things.
Okay.
Seeing something very important in that.
Yeah. I mean, metaphysics can easily lead us astray. And Whitehead's aim is to reform the metaphysical impulse, which tends to run off into abstraction, and to really orient it towards experience. He says the sole justification for any thought is the elucidation of experience.
A Buddhist,
And so to the extent that we're talking about something that cannot be experienced, that's a warning sign for Whitehead, whether it's metaphysics or in science too. It's one thing to say in physics, say, that we don't perceive atoms. But in principle, they are perceivable, right? And so as long as the unperceived is in principle perceivable, okay. But when science starts conjuring, I mean, string theory, very beautiful in theory, but it's impossible to test. And so at that point, science and metaphysics start to become indistinguishable. And Whitehead felt that that was problematic. Remember, nature is what we are aware of in perception, including extensions of perception by technologies, microscopes, telescopes, and so on. But we should avoid conjuring entities into existence and hypothetical mechanisms that might explain what we do perceive, but themselves remain not just unperceived, but unperceivable in principle. That's a problem. Right? And so while he's a speculative philosopher, it's a kind of speculative empiricism, if I can use that phrase. So we're trying to remain grounded in experience. And sometimes, well, often he found it necessary to come up with new words to describe experience, fresh articulations, so as to avoid assuming, you know, you think you know what he means by a word.
And it's striking that he takes religious experience seriously, because that's unusual for philosophers as far as I understand. They often seem to dismiss it as just out of court, you know, it's sort of, I don't know what they think it is, but it's very rarely brought in, you know, because, you know, many of my friends, and even including myself, have what you would might call religious experiences. I use the word religious in the sense of a word that connotes something that...
You could say spiritual experience.
Yes, except for spiritual sounds so woo-woo nowadays, doesn't it? It's, you know, it's, and no one knows what spiritual means anymore. It just sort of means whatever you like, I think. But religion gives it your sense, it has sort of connotations of dignity and... weight and reality. It's not
something,
just something
you're committed to.
Yes, and whereas spiritual always seems to me sort of a well-being matter. Anyway, where's what I go with that? But I'm struck that...
Why did Whitehead take religious experience?
I mean, he's got his own... His family is obviously experienced, but it does seem unusual that philosophers take...
He's an unusual philosopher.
I
mean, I often get asked, just because of how expansive his view of the universe is, that he must have had some sort of mystical experience, some sort of extraordinary event that changed him, that opened him to all of this. All that I don't know of any such, he never wrote about anything like that, other than his appreciation for the Romantic poets. He credits his wife, Evelyn, for sensitizing him to the importance of the arts and aesthetic experience. And the importance of emotion. Whitehead actually thinks that emotion, far from being something that only humans or mammals bring into the world, is actually quite fundamental, and that what physicists describe as you know, the transmission of energy as electromagnetic radiation, he says that's the objective measurable side of it, but the subjective interior side of it is pulses of emotion. Right? Why is that? Why are there even vectors of energy moving in a direction? He says, well, there's something like an aim or a desire, or an emotional motive that's driving energy to radiate, right? And so, you know, when we on a nice sunny day, which I hope we have tomorrow, and lay in the grass and take in that solar radiation, feels quite good up to a point. Whitehead would say we're actually feeling what it's like to be the sun, in some sense. We are absorbing. His term is prehension, which is, you think of comprehension or apprehension. He shortens it to prehension to signify that this is just a sort of basic feeling that has a vector. It's going from here to there, coming from the sun into us. And so while I don't become identical with the sun when I feel the warmth on my skin, I am feeling some sense, at least, of what it is like to be the sun, right? And so there's this, that's the intimate relationality here, that there's a transmission of feeling.
What does he mean by feeling? Because feeling's one of those words that blurs into emotionality almost on one end. Because Buddhism's got this word vedana, which means, it is often translated as feeling, which means more like feeling sensation, you know, something is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, is a classic description of vedana.
I mean, affect, you know, the what it's like to experience something, the qualitative nature of things. And it feels anthropomorphic, you know, when you start to attribute feeling and emotion to not just the living world of other biological creatures, but to the physical world as well. But, you know, for Whitehead, the difference between the physical and the biological is a matter of degree.
Right.
And there's in the philosophy of mind, there's something called the hard problem of consciousness, which is if you have the default view of a materialistic universe that's devoid of consciousness and interiority, it becomes very difficult to understand at what point this thing called consciousness came online. Is it just creatures with brains? Is it just creatures with language? Where does it come online? And then how does the brain do that trick? It becomes quite mysterious. And so Whitehead is a species of panpsychist. Panpsychism is this concept that's actually having a bit of a moment even among analytic philosophers right now because of how difficult the hard problem of consciousness is. It might in fact be impossible. More and more philosophers are saying, well, maybe there never was a moment when consciousness suddenly came online because matter took a certain shape or became organized in a certain way. Maybe there was always an interior dimension to the physical world. And what evolution is doing is deepening and complexifying that interior dimension, right? So there's no zero point of consciousness. And then there's no hard problem anymore.
Right, yeah. I mean,
there's other problems.
There's lots of other problems. I intuitively really like this idea of that everything having, as it were, an internal dimension, which, as it were, goes off into the dark, because that's one's experience of oneself. You know, when I experience myself in meditation or out of it, people always say to me, someone knows themselves. There always seems to be something unknowable about ourselves, ineffable even about ourselves. You know, self sort of disappears off into the dark. There's this internal dimension. And it does seem possible that everything has something like that. Is that what Whitehead, extrapolating from experience, is trying to say?
Yeah. I mean, the philosopher Alan Watts, I think you're wonderful, but I think he's probably my favorite Brit.
I can only be second. I'll do
my
it.
My favorite Buddhist Brit. Even, so, sorry.
Yay.
He said he was very influenced by Whitehead, and said that, you know, every being imagines that it's human, not just our species, you know, but the ladybugs, even an atom. And what he meant by that is every being experiences itself as at the center, right? In the middle of everything, having its own perspective, right? And so it doesn't mean literally every being thinks it's human, but every being thinks that this world exists for its sake.
Which again goes back to what Buddhism would say is the core delusion, is that you're in the center and you arranged the whole of the universe around you, which is obviously a delusion, isn't it?
Yes. But at the same time, we do live in an omnicentric universe, according to physics, right? And so maybe the delusion is a certain kind of fixation and reification of one's sense of self. But again, if the human is in this auspicious situation, it could be every being thinks it's human, but we have the capacity to overcome the delusion of thinking we're at the center.
I like that. So listen, we need to sort of start to draw this to a close, but I thought we'd be good to sort of talk about a little bit perhaps about how has this affected you? Has you been reading Whitehead for, I can't remember how long you've said, it's quite many years.
16, 17.
Yeah, it's a long time to be reading Whitehead and thinking about Whitehead.
It's not easy to read him, so it takes
no, indeed. How has that affected your life? Not just your your thinking, your teaching life, but how has it and has that affected your sense of things, the sense of yourself, the sense of value and so on? It might be nice to start with that story of your mother, you know, that you...
Well, when I'm asked why did I become how did I become a philosopher, I tell this story of being a 7-year-old and I was just bouncing on the bed, and my mom was on the phone with a friend of hers holding some laundry. And it just suddenly occurred to me that she was going to die one day. Mm. She was perfectly healthy at the time. It was just realizing that life is finite, but specifically her life. And for like 2 weeks, I would just burst into tears. And, you know, I tried to go to school. I would fake a stomach ache so she could come pick me up. I could make sure she was still alive. Mm. And the only thing that snapped me out of that was eventually I realized that I was going to die. Mm. And that evoked quite a different emotional response for me. It was quite mysterious. I wasn't afraid of it. Mm. And it made me question, if I couldn't remember when I was born, I didn't suddenly just wake up and say, oh, how did I get here? Mm. And so similarly, looking towards my death, I just thought, huh, it can't possibly just be that the lights go out and that's it, as if I never existed. Mm. And so experiencing the inevitability of death from my own perspective totally reconfigured how I related to the death of my mother. I mean, she's still alive. Mm. But as sad as losing a loved one to death can be, I realized that not only is it inevitable, but it's a profound mystery. Mm. And, you know, if we go back to the origins of Western philosophy in ancient Greece, Socrates says in the dialogue, or Plato has Socrates say in the dialogue Phaedo, right before he's drinking the hemlock, because Athens decided that he was corrupting the youth and didn't believe in the gods of the state and so on, they condemned him to death. He says, look, all of philosophy is preparation for dying, right? As D.H. Lawrence would say, we're building the ship of death, which is the soul. We don't need to think of the soul in a substantialist way. We can think of it poetically. And so I didn't know it at the time, but that's, I think, when I became a philosopher. Yeah. And I discovered Whitehead later. There are many other brilliant philosophers. And I'm particularly drawn to process philosophy because I think we're in the midst of an ecological, I don't even think crisis quite captures it, catastrophe. And this relational way of thinking, this recognizing that we exist amidst a democracy of fellow creatures, that nature is permeated by value and that our own human values are derivative, right? And if we can put the value of the earth at the center of our lives and relate to one another as earthlings, I think we have some chance of averting the catastrophic course that our civilization is on. And I find Whitehead's thought to be contributing immensely to the shift in worldview and the transformation of consciousness that would be required to move away from the sorts of anthropocentric values that we are currently guided by.
What values?
Anthropocentric,
Oh, yeah.
Human-centered values.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where nature is just raw material, waiting for human beings to come along and produce it, manufacture it into something, and then assign a monetary value to it. That's, I think, probably everyone in this room agrees is a disastrous path. But the habits of thought that drive us in that direction are so deeply rooted. I think metaphysics, though it's dangerous to engage in that sort of speculative thinking, abstract articulations of the ultimate nature of reality, I think we need to risk that because we're assuming a metaphysics whether we like it or not.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And so we need to make explicit what we're assuming and try out something else.
And in a certain sense, for me, that's where we started, is that people taking up Buddhism with a metaphysics that is alien to Buddhism.
Yeah.
You know, basically a nihilistic, materialistic, mechanistic metaphysics. It's not a description, it's a metaphysics. You know? So we do need to do our metaphysical work.
For better or worse?
Yeah.
I think so. Mm. Yeah.
That's a great place to finish. Thank you very much.
Thank you.